For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good morning, everyone. For new people, I'm Taigen Layton, the guiding Dharma teacher here at Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, and I'm very pleased to have with us giving the talk this morning Stephanie Kaza, who is one of the most eminent scholars of environment and environmental Buddhism, Buddhism and the environment. So she's a professor emerita of of environmental studies from the University of Vermont, former director of the University of Vermont Environmental Program. Her many books include Green Buddhism, Practice and Compassionate Action in Uncertain Times, Dharma Rain, Sources of Buddhist Environmentalism, Mindfully Green, Hooked, Buddhist Writings on Greed, Desire, and the Urge to Consume, and Conversations with Trees, an Intimate Ecology. She also most recently edited a book which I had the honor of contributing a chapter to, A Wild Love for the World, Joanna Macy and the Work of Our Time, about the work of, I don't know if you can see it, one of my mentors and friends, Joanna Macy. Very fine book. Stephanie also lived at Green Gulch Zen Center for a while. I think not at the same time I lived there. I think I must have been at Tassajara or City Center that time. But Stephanie is also a practitioner as well as an academic scholar. So I'm very happy to have Stephanie here. Also, she currently lives in Portland, Oregon. And so she had a chance to witness the recent and maybe current activities of the stormtroopers trying to stop the Black Lives Matter uprisings and demonstrations. So Stephanie has a lot to say, and I'm really happy to have you with us today, Stephanie. Thank you so much for coming.
Well, thank you, everybody, for inviting me and for thinking about these things with me today. I always feel that a Dharma talk is a chance to explore new territory and be a little brave stepping out into teachings that maybe are still maturing and still trying to sort this out. So I gave Taigen this title, The Dharma of Resistance, knowing there could be a lot in it and it could be something we could talk about together really well. It seems that doing anything environmental these days from a Buddhist perspective or any other perspective also involves justice issues and also involves protecting democracy. Protecting the climate isn't something distinct from protecting cultures and human values. So this field of practice has gotten really big over my lifetime. And I can't imagine it really being much bigger, but we're all exploring the edges of it right now. It's a very complicated practice field. Not that practice fields aren't always complicated, but we are living in quite a unique time. So let me just start a little bit about right here in Portland, because it's all about resistance, and it has become quite visceral and quite compelling. And always a story has helped set up where we are. I feel particularly, a good companionship with you because of the long history of resistance in Chicago, and that Chicago is also, in the crosshairs right now, and that there's been no shortage of action and support in Chicago. So my first experience with the early Black Lives Matter protests here in Portland were, of course, like everyone, night after night downtown, and concerns and about the virus, should I go or not go, that kind of thing. And then about the fifth night out after the killing of George Floyd, the long procession of maybe several thousand people came within a block of our house in one of the outer neighborhoods in Portland. And I got to be part of it for a little while and see how respectful and thoughtful and concerned and impassioned people were. And it was a wonderful thing. This was long before the federal agents came. You could feel how called everyone was to participate. This was so important. They had to be on the streets. Now, let me flash forward a little bit to just about a week or week and a half ago. And it seems that these protests here in Portland have been going on, as you know, every night. And I think part of the feeling is we cannot let the Black Lives Matter agenda slip out of sight. We just simply cannot, particularly in a city like Portland, which has a long history of racial exclusion. The whole state does. And it's a very white city. So we have a lot of homework here to do, a lot of catching up, a lot of reparations in this particular city. So I have been trying to find my way, as we all are, around this intersection of environmental work, racial justice work, and our current concerns about our democracy. And on this particular night, federal agents supposedly were no longer in the streets, but they were overhead. And it grabbed my attention. We had heard the planes before, and we had heard about how they were sucking up cell phone data. And it was very unnerving to feel you were being surveilled in a big circle flying around and around in this neighborhood. We knew that meant there would be some action at the local police precinct. And then sure enough, a couple of hours later, after the first plane was sighted around sunset, the loudspeakers went off from the police cars. This is an unlawful gathering. You must move to the east or be subject to crowd control methods. And we'd heard these a number of nights in a row. It had disturbed our sleep. It was a call to pay attention in the middle of the night and very upsetting. And so at this moment, I just decided to kind of race out into the street, almost, you know, forgetting what was at risk. Now, nothing terrible happened to me, but I was really thrilled to see so many neighbors, just ordinary people on the street, upset about what I was calling noise terrorism. The sound of that megaphone on top of the police car could be heard 10 block radius all the way around from it. So even as I'm mentioning this to you, I'm even kind of shaking a little with how upsetting this was and how much it triggers moment after moment the depth of our concerns. We can't protect anything about the environment or the climate without protecting the means to make decisions and work together, generate policies, and enforce laws. So this is, of course, I'm not saying anything new to you, but the physical experience of that sound jangling my nerves and throwing the whole neighborhood in an uproar. It's a neighborhood with a lot of apartment complexes, so people were really out there on a warm summer night. So this is my most recent visceral experience of resistance, and I'll come back to it later. But I wanted to just look at that word for a minute. And I found something from a professor in your neighborhood at Indiana U, William Shoreman, professor of political science, who simply called resistance a principled opposition to the existing order. Principled opposition to the existing order. Now, one problem with resistance, and we'll come back to this in a Dharma sense, it has always been an ambiguous term. It could mean violent resistance or nonviolent resistance. And sometimes it aims at revolution, complete overhaul of existing society. I found a little interesting footnote about that famous essay by Thoreau. You know the one, Civil Disobedience. Well, the original title for that essay was Resistance to Civil Government. And the editor thought that was too radical a title. Now, as an editor, I'm always interested in these word changes and what they represent. So apparently at that time, the word resistance was too strong to title something. And also for Thoreau, he felt very much resistance was an individual moral act. He was trying to draw our attention to how to think about positions we would take and how we would defend them as individuals. And in fact, Thoreau is a kind of paragon of individualism in our Western sort of American philosophical thought. And to that extent, he maybe is not so useful to us today when moral actions are collective. Today, the actions in the street are people working out together how to put a different story forward. But today's resistance movements are, of course, part of a long history, and we won't go into that, but we can think of the French resistance during the Nazi occupation, of course, all the civil rights actions with Martin Luther King, John Lewis, and our modern movements, Black Lives Matter and the Me Too movement. But this is a Dharma talk, so we get an opportunity to look very closely and with an attentive mind about the nature of resistance. How do we work with this broad field we call resistance from the perspective of the Dharma as a practice field, not just something political or social? Well, my training is in the sciences, so I always enjoy with a concept like this, returning to the most elemental aspects of it. So you could say, in the pure definition of resistance, that it's an instance or an action of resisting, or the capacity to resist, or a force that opposes, something that slows things down or stops things. Now, in physics, that tension is used to hold energy potential. It's really the basis of electricity. Having some opposition to certain kinds of metallic substances allows current to pass through them. So resistance becomes a way of transforming energy. And just that metaphorical understanding is profound for our own personal expressions and understandings of resistance and how we see these movements working. There's also thermal resistance in physics, which is a kind of heat property that tells you how quickly or slowly or how it changes a material for heat flow to move through it. Resistance becomes the opposite of conductance. So these are metaphors we can draw on. For me, biology is a little bit more familiar, and I think about the life of organisms to withstand destructive conditions or agents, to withstand predation or toxins or pathogens, disease, or some kind of environmental stressor like strong wind, pounding rains, severe floods. So it's a resistance in an organism is a very important aspect of your evolutionary success. Without really highly developed mechanisms of resistance, you won't survive as an organism. You will be carried away or eaten or injured. So resistance is highly refined, evolutionarily tested capacity. And that's really a beautiful thing to think about in human form, and something we could reflect on the cushion even. What are the human capacities for resistance at a biological level? Our immune systems, our capacity to run from danger, our very complicated brains that can take us out of dangerous situations. So our very fundamental biology has resistance as a critical part of survival. But of course, we're also witnessing resistance, and in trying to look at it dharmically, it's interesting to look at how it expresses socially. And as human beings, we're social animals. So this self-protection mechanism becomes protection for culture, or protection for the tribe or the family or the city in this case, in Portland. And there are mechanisms for maintaining that resistance. This might sound kind of abstract, but if you think about rituals, languages, protected spaces, this is all about how to keep resistance strong within a social culture. So one of the interesting things in Portland is seeing how the culture in the streets has evolved over time to protect that resistance of the resistors. And you've probably seen some of the images. We're sort of beginning to look like Hong Kong, actually, downtown. The umbrellas, the goggles, and protection, facial and, you know, gas masks, everybody wearing a helmet. These are all ways to increase resilience and also to increase tribal strength. So the medics, the street medics, don't have to work with everybody, because there are those who are protecting the resilience of the group and helping the resistance of the entire gathering be strong against these attacks from the police brutality. So this is a little introductory way to just think about, how does resistance work? How do we observe it carefully, biologically, socially, culturally? Now, when we think about practicing with resistance, trying to develop capacity to understand it, to be aware of how resistance manifests in us individually and in our surroundings, that this is a big study. So practicing with this, I thought immediately of the schedule. And you as Zen students know exactly what I mean. Any time that you have a retreat, or even this morning for a Dharma talk, the schedule determines how we are all able to be together. And on a day retreat, a week-long retreat, I imagine that you have each at some point had some resistance to the schedule. So I just, as a point of commonality, wanted to take a moment to ask you to call that to mind. Just see if you can, something pops up in your mind when you just didn't want to be in the Zendo. You came up with an excuse. You were sitting there chafing. Just see if that can come into your mind and remember. How are you feeling physically? Were you fidgeting? Were you in tears of frustration? Emotionally? Did you feel oppressed by the schedule? Or manipulated, or bound in some way? How about your mental state? Did you have any opinions about the people that put the schedule together? What were they thinking? How could we possibly do that much zazen in a day? You may have had your own internal revolution in the planning state. How would you leave this retreat? Undercover, through sickness? Seasoned teachers have seen all of this and talked about it in Dokusan, or maybe not. Like, the schedule is the schedule. We just aren't going to talk about it. You just do it. But there is so much to study about resistance during a retreat. It's often one of the main things that comes up for people, pain and resistance. So this is very helpful. And of course, the guiding teacher will always point you back to that. What can you learn from this? I'm bringing this up now because it dovetails perfectly with observing our own resistance to what's going on in our world today and how resistance is taking different forms socially and culturally. But I felt that I really wanted to read those opening verses from the Affirming Faith and Mind. They're so perfect for this. The great way is not difficult for those who do not pick and choose. When preferences are cast aside, the way stands clear and undisguised. But even slight distinctions made set earth and heaven far apart. If you would clearly see the truth, discard opinions pro and con, to founder in dislike and like is nothing but the mind's disease. Now, you could read those verses and think, I better not have any political opinions. You know, that would be picking and choosing. Maybe I just won't even vote. But that's not what it's about. It's really here about being completely aligned and at one with what's going on and not separating from it. So this is an interesting conundrum with resistance. It requires some object to resist. It's a little bit like perception that way. You cannot have sight without an object of seeing. You cannot have taste without an object of tasting. So the resistance is through the resistance to something is how the energy is generated. But that doesn't mean opposition. That doesn't necessarily mean a dualistic relationship. So this is the dharmic insight that makes resistance a broader field. When it's oppositional and in the streets with one side fighting another, there's no question it's a dualistic field of extreme emotion, fear, and separation. And that's what we've seen with the police versus the protesters. There's no understanding that they're part of one system. And the violence shows that. But from a Dharma perspective, you could be in the same situation and be part of all that's going on, even while the energy is moving through that resistance. Now, another phase of resistance that's very important to look at is the nature of clinging and grasping. That energy in the relationship with the object that I'm talking about could also be a strong attachment to something that's generating a passionate response and compelling you to move forward around something. But ultimately, clinging and grasping becomes an obstacle, as we know from all our Dharma study. So this presents an even greater challenge in this practice field. How to experience and work with the energy of transformation that's right there in resistance without clinging to it. Now, a third aspect, if we are doing a kind of analytical approach here, I would say, resistance is very often a pointer to what needs attention. Just seeing that resistance to what we don't want to look at or don't want to feel, what's causing suffering, resistance is our friend. Resistance tells us this needs your attention now. So the street protests are doing this for our entire country. This needs your attention now. But individually, we may feel this kind of resistance that points to what needs attention in other ways. For example, you may feel a great weight and need to just sleep when something feels when grief is very heavy, and not even know that's why you keep lying down. A kind of burden of emotion. And the resistance, no, I shouldn't lie down, or why am I trying to avoid this, compels you as a practitioner to ask, what is going on? What is this resistance leading me to? So these are all kind of analytical approaches to resistance that are something you can do in a quiet space of meditation, but also on the streets, in the midst of action. I'll tell you a bit later, I'm not sure I was that successful, but I think it's a dharmic call to keep this analytical insight right up front and not be caught up in mistaken understanding. Now, but the other thing we're seeing on the streets, and I'm in Buddhist practice, I'm particularly interested in this, is resistance as discernment for action, an ethical approach. So very quickly in any situation that's complicated, we get compounded resistance. So that's what I'm calling it. You might have, there might be resistance to a certain particular object, like here, the police, the federal agents. Nobody wanted them in the city or in the state, and they were expressing that resistance strongly. The governor, our senators, our legislators, our mayor, our city council. But that was compounded by people's emotional responses and some of the actions they took, and the Black Lives Matter cultures conflicting with the Antifa over what the goals were. It gets complicated very quickly. So to choose an action based in Buddhist principles, Buddhist precepts of non-harming requires ethical discernment, sorting through what would be helpful resistance that would reduce harm and suffering, and what is unhelpful or unskillful resistance. It may not reduce harm at all, and it may even cause harm. So it's quick, it's easy to see, and at least I will testify as a witness here in Portland, that the federal agent's presence in Portland became unskillful very quickly, not to mention very costly. I, as a taxpayer, did not appreciate that. But helpful resistance is what is transforming our understanding about Black Lives Matter in this case. Apparently, all the books on anti-racism, how to be an anti-racist, you know, mindful of race, all of those are the top library demands right now in our city. Like the top five are all about this. And that's also happening with book sales. So this is contributing to helpful resistance. One of my guiding questions as a professor with students many activist students, of course, in environmental studies, many frustrated activist students trying to find their way, I would say, what can you actually do? This was my small B Buddhist discerning question for them. It was a skillful means question. And in it, I was asking them, what do you know that you can employ here? You know, what courses have you taken? What experiences? Do you have a position of power you can use? Are you the head of student government or of some student organization? How much time are you willing to commit? How important is this to you? Well, this became, I'll digress for a minute, this became particularly important during that divestment campaign. Students very, very much wanted the University of Vermont to divest its endowment funds from all fossil fuels and anything that was contributing to climate change. They were part of this global movement, which is now enormous. Trillions of dollars have been divested. But when did we start? 15 years ago, maybe. This was a difficult challenge, and the board of trustees was not too interested in divesting. And the students would have their kind of die-ins, you know, go to the during the breaks at the board meetings and just lie down everywhere on the floor. And they were kind of hard to miss. And, you know, board meeting after board meeting, nothing would change. So what they could actually do for a long-term project like this was very limited and very frustrating. But they stayed on it, and I was happy to be part of that as the faculty advisor for a socially responsible investment advisory committee, which at least the board was willing to allow us to have and advise them. Anyway, many years later, I think it was just within the last year, UVM did decide to divest with a change of board president and change of student leadership. And that line, what can you actually do, kept generating more and different forms of resistance and pressure until that much energy flowed through the system, transforming it and allowing University of Vermont to join the many other universities and pension funds and cities who are turning the tide against fossil fuels and fossil fuel infrastructure. A very huge challenge, but a necessary challenge in terms of climate change. We're trying to change an entire economy based on the addictive rush of fossil fuels. So the reason this divestment campaign worked was because it had solid ethics underneath it, all the way, start to finish. The resistance of the students continued to ask of them to discern why they were doing it, why it was ethical, and why it mattered that they continue to participate in this divestment. Now, I want to change gears here a little bit to look at one specific practice field that suits us very well as Dharma practitioners. We'll step back from the streets for a minute. And this topic came to me from a book I highly recommend, How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. So of course, that word resisting got my attention. And the author is Jenny Odell. It's quite a powerful book. And we should start with, what does she mean by the attention economy? Well, the attention economy is making money off of our attention. I'll just say the word Facebook, and that will help you know what I mean. Anywhere that the clickbait of our attention is drawn in, of course, primarily on the internet now, but also on phones, you know, all the social media, that is designed to grab our attention. No question about that. Whether it's through blinking a little or using repeating motions or certain colors, advertising graphic designers and computer designers, this is their primary goal, how to build distraction into our attention field and then make money from it. Oh, I didn't even mention game apps. Now, what about those? So Jenny Odell wants to look at patterns of attention and how, through resisting the attention economy, we gain a lot more energy for doing important work, the real work, not this distraction stuff. So let me just read a little couple of quotes from her. The patterns of attention, what we choose to notice and what we do not, where our attention goes, are how we render reality for ourselves and thus have a direct bearing on what we feel is possible at any given time. The villain here is not necessarily the internet or even the idea of social media. It is the invasive logic of commercial social media and its financial incentive to keep us in a profitable state of anxiety, envy, and distraction, leading to a cult of individualism. Now, I think you can get very quickly what I'm pointing to here, and she is, that the attention economy has, well, stolen our attention to a large degree, partly because we need the internet to communicate and to now learn with each other and do Dharma practice together, but it's filled with distraction. So Jenny Odell, her main title, How to Do Nothing, actually it's a very active nothing. It's a kind of Buddhist nothing, actually. And if you read this book, you'll see how influenced she is by Buddhism and mindfulness. But doing nothing is an act of resistance to the attention economy. And I think you could even imagine that being in the streets is an act of resistance to the attention economy because there's no profit to be made in the streets. Nobody is gaining from people out speaking their values publicly in a social gathering like that. So what would resistance look like? What does she mean, resisting the attention economy? And you may already have some experience with this, that sense that if the attention economy grabbed you too late at night, you couldn't sleep very well. Or in the morning, perhaps you just checked the headlines of the New York Times and then somehow doing Zazen wasn't the same afterwards. The attention economy is so close, so intimate, so interwoven with our social lives today that it takes a lot of waking up to even notice that it's there, and then resisting it is another project altogether. Excuse me. So Jenny Odell suggests that to resist in place, she talks a lot about being where you're grounded, is to make oneself into a shape that cannot so easily be appropriated by a capitalist value system. Honestly, I think that could be said for Zazen, that Zazen is a resistance to the attention economy in its very nature. But what this requires is refusing the frame of reference. So it takes a little thinking about that the frame of reference for the attention economy is that value is determined by productivity, how much of it this can be made, how many clicks, how many purchases, how fast things happen on the web or on phone apps, or other frames of references around individual accomplishment and career achievement. So she suggests that maybe just our experience of life could be a higher goal and something that would not support the attention economy. We would be out there with the trees and the birds and the people in the streets and our gardens, none of which is really allocated much time or space on the attention economy. So this is relevant to what I started out talking about, political resistance, because there are parallels between what the economy does to an ecological system, the exploitation for metals, for timber, for water. Our economy is an exploitative, resource extractive economy. Now parallel that with what the attention economy does to our attention. It's exploiting it, it's extracting it, and it's undermining our full, beautiful human capacity for giving our attention, our intimacy, our undivided awareness of this amazing world. So again, to quote Jenny Odell, to pay attention to one thing is to resist paying attention to other things. It means constantly denying and thwarting provocations outside the sphere of one's attention. Just as it takes alignment for someone to concentrate and act with intention, it requires similar alignment for a movement to move. Now, she wrote this book before the protests in the streets. So I'm trying to put these two things together and seeing that why those protests are so powerful is that they use their attention tools to set them up, to figure out where they will meet and, you know, send those messages underground. But that's a very minor use of the attention economy, and no one's making money off of it. And then once they're in the streets, all the attention is on the issues, on the concerns of police brutality, on the policy demands that are now, at least here, working our way through the legislature and the city council. But her point of paying attention to one thing really requires you to have a strong enough intention to resist paying attention to other things. So resisting the attention economy is a struggle. It's one we can all engage in. And I think this might be a clue for how we work our way through this difficult, complex time that is asking so much of us. In the attention economy, we get kind of stuck in a flat digital world that's only about the constant present moment of you and the screen mode. And it collapses past and future. And the climate movement, the justice movement, is all about the past and the future. What we need to repair from the past, reparations, and what we have karmically created through our climate fossil fuel economies, and to the future we want, to a sustainable future that has more room for kindness and life to really thrive, an economy of well-being, an economy of value. So resisting the attention economy gives us a path, a way forward towards creating this much more sustainable, thriving world, rather than being trapped in a kind of fearful present filled with anxiety. Now, I've given you a lot to think about here. And I think this last part will be rather obvious, that mindfulness and our practice on the cushion is incredibly helpful, skillful means for reclaiming our attention from the attention economy and for supporting ethical resistance as a skillful means in today's complicated set of challenges. So I turn to one of my favorite writers, Bhante Gunaratana. His Mindfulness in Plain English is a book I return to many times. And in the section on dealing with distractions, written far before all these street protests, he talks about concentration and mindfulness going hand in hand. They complement each other. If one is weak, the other is affected. You can be mindful, but without concentration, your mind just sort of floats around. So you need methods of establishing your concentration. So you can see right away that distracting electronic devices really impact concentration. But mindfulness is, as he says, disarms distractions. An interesting metaphor, he says, in the same way that a munitions expert might defuse a bomb. That's very powerful. Now, a weak distraction, you can disarm by a single glance. You get up and leave your computer or your phone, whatever is maintaining that attention economy. And once understood, you aren't as hooked into them any longer. But as he says, deep-seated, habitual thought patterns require constant mindfulness, repeatedly applied over whatever time period it takes to break their hold. Distractions are really paper tigers. They have no power of their own. They need to be fed constantly or else they die. So this book, How to Do Nothing, was a kind of guidebook to deep-seated habitual thought patterns that certainly I have developed as a professor, needing to use these digital tools over time, and as an activist, needing to know what's going on and how I can contribute and where my input will be helpful. So let me just finish my story here in closing. There I was in the streets, trying to be a small B Buddhist practitioner, very upset by this noise terrorism, feeling it was so invasive. And I was caught, honestly, by anger and really mad about it. It hurt my ears when I got up close. I thought what I would do would be, I would just kind of, you know, like yell at the police to turn the volume down. I was so naive. I had the instinct that you have when your neighbor is making too much noise with some loud music, or you're in a campground and somebody's, you know, interfering with your, you know, the peacefulness. It never occurred to me how much I worried my husband when I just went bolting out. He was very concerned that anytime anyone right now in Portland gets too close to a police car, you don't know what's going to happen. I was caught up. My attention was claimed by the momentum, the terrorizing sound, the power of solidarity of the people in the streets. I needed to come back, which I did. I will tell you, I didn't get hurt. The sounds kept going. And I had to find my way back to more skillful means. I was really flooded with adrenaline. And that was a lot of energy. So it was either going to eat me alive and keep me up all night, or it needed to take some new form. It needed to go through that electrical conductance that I mentioned in the physics sense. And it also needed to help me be strong as a human being so I could continue to pay attention to what's going on here in Portland. Well, what I did do was I wrote a letter to my senator, Michael Dambrow, and I get news bulletins from him every day. He's keeping us up to date on the virus. But he is also keeping us up to date on special legislative sessions where they have taken up bills on regulating police action, things like banning chokeholds and tear gas use. And I made the case for banning noise terrorism. Just one more voice. And I also sat down and really listened to my husband. I had lost track of concerns for my own safety. And I heard what his experience was, that he was grateful that our neighbor, a young man, went out into the streets and said, "I'll be a shield for her." It was a strong moment. So I bring this to you today as part of my own reflections on the nature of resistance, how to recognize it both internally, understand how it works socially, and be discerning about what kind of resistance, resistance to what really is going on, how to keep the focus on the resistance that's trying to press forward, and in this case, around the demands and the reparations needed as they're outlined by the Black Lives Matter and many other groups. If you're interested in what's happening in Oregon, there's a whole compilation put together called Reimagine Oregon of demands and thoughts from many different Black-led movements. And really, my big question through all this is what skillful means can be helpful in studying from a Dharma perspective in the quiet of my calm mind. What is the nature of resistance, and how can it be part of our engagement with this very complicated world? So let me close with that. We'll have some question and answer and time together around. I hope you will illuminate many more aspects of the Dharma of resistance. Thank you very much.
And thank you very much, Stephanie. So we have some time for anyone who has comments, questions, responses to Stephanie, and your very helpful, powerful talk. So people can just raise your hands if you want to respond or have comments, or also if you go to the participants box on the bottom, and there's a place on the bottom of the participants box where you can just click on raise hand, and I will call on people. You can either raise your hand in the participants box or just raise your hand visually, and please, questions or responses for Stephanie. So, Fuxian.
Thank you so much, Stephanie. This question of resistance is just a wonderful and very timely question. I have a question about the use in your imaging of resistance, of opposition. And you did mention the kind of koan that the notion of opposition, as you offered it to us in terms of, you know, the physical resistance of conductors and resistance. And I wonder, you know, in the spirit of your wonderful talk, and you're one of the things that you said, Jenny O'Dell suggests is reframing something. If maybe, you know, in addition to the questioning character of being intimate with our present structures of politics and government and police violence, whether there might be another way of thinking of resistance other than opposition, like engagement or, you know, just so that if bringing the Dharma to our present circumstances would require us, it seems, would call us to think in other terms than in terms of opposition. So I wonder if you had any more to say about how else we might. I mean, I know that you said a lot, but maybe the question of this word opposition and dualism, the dualistic mindset that that we could bring with us as we work through these terribly difficult problems?
Well, your Zen practice is a wonderful gift. And Taigen in particular is one of the teachers who's worked a lot with non-dualistic intimacy and non-dualistic thinking and perception. It's emphasized more in Zen than almost any of the other Buddhist traditions. So it's very germane to your question. So I was trying to imagine that one could act in opposition from a non-dualistic frame, taking a stance. This will be my position in this system, but I'm not separating myself from the police, say, in this case, if it's an oppositional stance. I am also understanding they have families, they have regulations, they have acceptable practices that they have been told are okay within their frame of reference. It makes it much more challenging. It's really easy to just kind of oppose and hate and be dualistic. That's a kind of old tribal impulse. The other as threatening. That is something we're seeing, a trope that's being used over and over in today's political discourse. It's really quite toxic, whether the other is Muslim or the other is China or the other, pick your other thing to other. So we know well how destructive dualistic opposition is. So engaging opposition in a non-dualistic way is a kind of a koan, but I think it's really quite possible for us, an aware practitioner. And in the street, what I'm guessing is that the street medics are people that are able to do that very well, because they see that injury is the main thing they want to attend to. Everyone is capable of being injured. Also, the people that are feeding others are down there. There was a rib place, Riot Ribs is the name of the place, and people were donating so much food to the cooks at Riot Ribs and money. Keep this going. We're feeding everybody down there. They stopped accepting the money. They said, we don't need any more. We've got plenty of food. We can feed everyone. So what I chose to do, I had to accept that I was not sophisticated or aware enough in that moment to be part of this street protest, because I was so upset by the noise that I was in an oppositional dualistic mode. But when I returned home, I took the action of writing, which was an engaged action with someone I knew who was active. I know what committees he's on. I know he's got highly respected in the Senate, and he knows who I am. I've gone to his constituent coffees. I found a place where what could I actually do seemed to make sense and channeled that energy. So I could suggest a lot of things. There's many different activist kind of techniques of how to engage. Everything from, becoming informed to joining with others, lobby days, etc. I think all of us probably need to go a little beyond our comfort zones in this. It's easy to just read about things and learn. And believe me, that's one of my preferences as a professor. Read as much as you can so you can teach. But I think to find our way through this election, we're going to need people to step forward. There's something like 100 ways listed in a new publication, How to Save Our Election. I might not have the title just right, but how many different things we are going to need to do in every different state and city, whether it's saving the postal service, or I could go on about the specifics, but there's no shortage of ways to engage. And I think the the non-dualistic part of it is really realizing how much is at stake and how much we are all part of what that is. So I'm not completely sure I've answered your question, but we can still work in this practice field together around that. I'm interested if other people have comments too around this.
Thank you. Other comments, responses, questions, raise your hand, or you can raise your hand in the participants window. Jokai Ian.
Hi, Stephanie. I was wondering if you could discuss social media and how we could even begin to live in balance with it and have it not consume our attention completely. How can we practice resistance without becoming Luddites, I guess, without just deleting our accounts completely?
Well, I like the way you phrased that, without becoming Luddites, because that's kind of what you think it's going to take, a fast or a withdrawal of some kind, and just I'll just run away from my phone and my internet. Maybe a sort of parallel or an analog might be how we manage our food diet. So you can do one day fasts and reset your body if it's had too much sugar or too much alcohol or too much caffeine. Or you can study on any kind of diet program, you write down everything you eat and drink, and then you see, oh, I thought I only had one cookie a day, but it looks like I have five cookies. I didn't realize. You do a kind of honesty tracking sort of thing. Or you set goals, like I'm going to try some food practices. If I eat meat, maybe I will not eat meat one day a week. There's a huge range of food practice, right? So if you take that as an analog, it might be, let me study my my digital use. Where is my phone across the day? Is it in my pocket all day long? Is it, by the bedside? Just what's my relationship to my phone? Just keeping an eye on that. I know there's apps on phones that they'll tell you how many minutes you've spent on the phone. So just like a diet, you can, keep track and then decide you want to bring it down perhaps. So there are tracking mechanisms. Same with the internet. I think this would be harder, but it might be something like how many minutes am I spending working puzzles, reading the Dharma, reading the news? What are the things I do? What goes into my diet on the internet? How much is email? How much is, what are all the parts of my digital diet? And which of those might I want to reduce or expand? What is my tolerance for the amount of screen time I can be part of effectively? One small observation from the pandemic for me is that I've noticed when I'm on Zoom calls with Dharma practitioners, my attention is much stronger and better because everyone else is more quiet and still in their bodies. It's a profound difference than being on other kinds of Zoom calls where people are eating and drinking and chatting and leaning, their bodies are all over the place. It's very distracting and very hard to pay attention. It's qualitatively different. So noticing the different qualities in the phone and internet experience, it's more discernment practice. So in a sense, the results of your discernment may help you change your diet, but it will also develop discernment capacity. Can you quickly close ads that are still popping open and, and flashing at you? Can you learn how to do that so it's not something that's eating your attention, whether you pay, you're really there or not, it's still fluttering there. So those are a few things, but I think the diet approach gives you a lot of room to try things like a day without opening the laptop. Just, see what it's like. Or waiting till I know some writers who say, I think it was Sue Moon who mentioned this, she won't open her laptop until noon, and any writing that happens is on paper before that. And that's how she's reclaimed her attention for that much of the day. There's a few ideas.
Thank you. Deborah has something.
Hi. I just wanted to thank you so much for the talk. I appreciated your ability to link, you know, our Dharma practice or Zazen. When I was listening to you, it your words really affected that how we feel in our bodies towards something, which occurs in Zazen, could be a good guide. And it's one of the things that comes up for me with all of these issues, social justice, Black Lives Matter, environment, is what is the right response, or a thoughtful, careful, skillful response? And that obviously that's a koan for each of us. I'm not expecting you to answer that, but I just appreciated your talk because it supported that we keep practicing and discerning, as you say. And I really liked your wording of a practice field. And I think now I'm going to try to have conversations with my friends on these broader issues, because I feel such urgency, like it can't be ignored anymore. So I just wanted to thank you for promoting my awareness and maybe the rest of us today. Thank you.
You know, let me add one more thing to that practice field concept. Talking with your friends, that's a practice field itself, right? And from a systems theory perspective, or if you're thinking about the system of all this going on, the conversation with your friends gives you a chance to amplify certain issues or values or actions that you want to bring attention to. There's conversations that are just kind of chatter that go on, and you know, you never know how, where they're going, where they're coming. But if your intention is to draw your friends' attention to these issues, then you may want to even prepare, what are my skillful means with this particular person? How could I bring this up? So that the conversation doesn't just fly by without really amplifying something of importance. It's interesting to study this process of amplifying. I have to say, I don't have a lot of stomach for watching Fox News, but they are masters at amplifying, at taking the slightest conspiracy theory or insult and hammering it over and over, and they're using that amplifying as a way to drown out other messages. So it requires, if we want some other messages to be out there, we need to amplify them at every possible level, to like concern about the election, or how will we manage to get all the ballots in and counted in time. Just how do we do this? So you can be very intentional in your conversations as a small B Buddhist, and that may be your best, most powerful locus for your engagement. Friend to friend, peer to peer is the strongest human relationship. And you, each person that you're speaking with has different capacities. Somebody might be a lawyer, someone might be, you know, work in a grocery store where they talk to people. They each have their own positionality, their own circle of friends, other ways to amplify these things. So it's a kind of widening circle, and that's a beautiful thing to imagine in your mind with each of these conversations that you take up.
Yeah. So thank you.
David, Ray.
Thank you so much for that rich talk. I think I will be sitting with a lot of that every day for a long time to come. Thank you especially for the connection between resistance in the political and activist sense on the one hand, and then on the other hand, thinking about the ways that resilience, you know, maintains the survival of systems, including the human organism. That's really a new insight to me. And a question that I have that I would really like to hear your take on has to do with the place of thoroughgoing passions like anger, or you used the word upset, indignation, righteous indignation, all of those, arguably unsatisfactory, arguably undeveloped primitive emotions that on the other hand are the thing that, that power certain forms of action. It's the thing that got you out into the street with all the risk of that. But in a way, that's the thing that made that story happen. So I'd love to hear your thoughts about the place of those angry, indignant passions in resistance.
That's really, it's a wonderful question. You should see all the books on anger I've got here in my bookshelf. Any Buddhist book that comes out about anger, I need to hear what somebody said for exactly that reason. Quite a while ago, when Thich Nhat Hanh was really becoming very popular in the United States and on tour, he was inventing a lot of new kinds of retreats, retreats with veterans, retreats with artists, and he had one for environmentalists. And I was so excited. My people, they'll all be there. And we wanted to network like crazy. It was like, wait, we're so upset about everything. Let us talk. Well, the people with the mindfulness bell were, kind of using it to shut us all up. It was the funniest experience that whenever people would be gathering somewhere, kind of networking, someone would miraculously come along and ring this mindfulness bell, and we were supposed to suddenly be quiet. So the head of Rainforest Action Network at the time, Randy Hayes, was on this retreat, and I was there too, and we decided we would offer a little workshop on the side called Sacred Rage to address exactly this topic, because we were struggling with it, how to have this much energy be expressed and do it skillfully. So that becomes the question. I will say that I'm incredibly grateful at all the neurological work that's being done now around freeze, fight, flight, the understanding of the sympathetic nervous system. And as you can imagine, and maybe this is true for some of you, I am much more activated in that sympathetic nervous system than the parasympathetic, which is the calming, restorative, reparation side of the nerves. But we're now understanding how you can activate that too much and you draw down your cortisol levels and then you don't have anything to work with. The acupuncturists will say, oh, your kidney yang is too low. And it's exactly that. It's a biological thing that's going on when those passions rage. So as I've gotten older, in particular, and understood this a little bit more, I've learned that I have to channel this much more skillfully. Younger people have excess energy; they don't need to guard it quite as carefully. But I do see that in some Buddhist circles, there's a kind of over strict understanding of the precept about not bearing ill will, thinking that it means don't get angry. And that's not correct. Anger is a natural protective mechanism. It's the bearing of ill will, the holding the grudges, the using it to hurt others that is the false or the error in trying to adhere to that precept. So what this really calls for is understanding how anger, rage, frustration, all those different related emotions work in your own personal physical system and how they work like wildfire in a social system. How one person's anger can spark another and how it can quickly get out of control. So it takes all the calm people in a march, the wall of moms, the wall of vets, and so on, to contain and hold the energy of the anger moving it forward. But not to dampen it, but more to like husband it like a good fire, that you can manage a beautiful fire if you have the water nearby and the fuels managed and so on. So that's been one of my metaphoric study areas. I love building fires, tending them, noticing what they need, and keeping them within bounds. And when I see wildfires, I can see what happens when the rage within a natural system that you could call fire becomes very destructive. But even that, I won't take a dualistic perspective on it, even though it's kind of horrifying. Forest fires are part of the overall natural resilience in natural systems too. This is an area of exploration for me continuously. So I really appreciate you brought it into the conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Stephanie. And I'll say that for me as an activist, that was a big part of how I came to Buddhism, was to learn how to use my anger constructively and not be controlled by it. So for me, the power of anger can be constructive, and it also can be destructive, and how to balance that is an important part of practice for me. So thank you. Other comments? Anyone? Right? Paul Disco, please.
Thank you very much. That was a very, very, very provocative talk. It brought out things that I've wanted to think about, but sort of pushed to the side because they're a little too difficult to think about. But because Buddhism, the practice of Buddhism is beyond good and bad. So if you start mixing it with political activity, there's a problem. There's some that problem that I don't know how to resolve, but there is a problem. And I've just sort of pushed it aside thinking that, well, there's a problem. That's it. But all the things that you have brought out makes me think that historically Buddhism has dealt with this issue in the sense that the Zazen practice or Buddhist practice is to make you as clear as possible, not to make a judgment or not to come down on one side or the other, but to clarify your delusions so that you see things clearly. And then you can be the best at whatever you're going to be. If you're going to be a fireman, you can be the best fireman. You'll not get caught by other worries. You'll put out the fire as the fire what needs to be put out. Or if you're going to be a farmer, you'll be the best farmer, the best banker, or even the best policeman. So our Zazen can make us the best rebels for a new understanding of social order, which I think is very important right now. I'm lifelong railing against the establishment. It's definitely a part of my mental makeup. But how to do that in a way that is not self-destructive is always the question. And I think that you have brought out some wonderful points about how we can do that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and it's a treat to see you here, Paul. It's been a very long time since your days at Green Gulch. Well, I want to just emphasize the ethical discernment part, because we can get quite confused by the thises and thats, the political parties, the candidates, the perspectives, the platforms. But from our Buddhist perspective, we have one thing to always return to as the foundation of our ethical choices, and that is, does this cause suffering or not? Our first precept, to not harm. So we can use that as an evaluative tool also. Is this party causing harm? Is this decision causing harm? Like the post service, you know, the postal service choices right now, many people are commenting on, this will cause a lot of harm. So something that causes a lot of harm, we can then justify we understand our resistance because it's based in wanting to not cause harm and wanting to reduce suffering. So that is always something to return to. And I use that when I feel a little overwhelmed or confused. How am I going to sort my way through this? And I find that the Buddhist precepts are really remarkably solid in this. They will support you through anything political. They really give a way to find a path forward. So that's a part of our practice we can take with us into any of these arenas. There will still be problems. There are always problems. We're human beings and we squabble. We just are such a mess with each other. But we can find paths forward, and some paths are better than others and will cause less harm. So that's our challenge in this kind of triple threat of, you know, working with racism and the need for racial justice, working with this impossible biological organism that is fooling everybody into what it will do, and then the threats to our democracy. Where it's quite a historic moment. We want to be quite heads up through all of this as much as possible. Well, thank you, everyone, for your really wonderful, good comments. And I'm happy to continue, but we'll follow the schedule. What's next?
So thank you so much, Stephanie, for your wonderful, thought-provoking talk. And yes, the Bodhisattva values, Bodhisattva precepts can help guide us in terms of how do we respond to all of these challenges, climate and the pandemic and the great injustices and the legacy of slavery and racism. And so, yeah, we have to look at how do we respond. And thank you so much for your guidance in this.